Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jonathan Gray, who's certainly one of our favorite guests. And we're going to be talking about religious matters. Now, here we are, certainly most people are concerned about Barack Obama's birth certificate, and Chris, when it turned out that this certainly was a fraud in multiple layers, it had been prepared in a birth, some sort of a Photoshop, and Chris, we know that, of course, that Barack Obama had spent almost $2 million of his own money to hire lawyers to challenge the people who were saying he was born in Kenya or he wasn't a legitimate American citizen. So they had to come up with an explanation, so they came up with a phony birth certificate, and that was easily challenged. It was a very, very amateurish duplicate. And so then suddenly we've got the death of bin Laden, and now, of course, everything's all right. We've shifted the focus for the attention of the American people from one issue to another. But all of this is political theater, because the real battle is not Obama against some of the Republican challengers or John Boehner, who heads the Republican Party, against the people who lead the Democrat Party, Harry Reid. What we're seeing is a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And that's why I've asked Jonathan to come and to talk about the things that are spiritual, because I think we have to keep our attention focused on what this is really all about. The other issues are really very exciting and to get us all whipped up and get us arguing back and forth. But there are things that are of eternal value and eternal significance that we really should be focused on. And so I've asked Jonathan to come and talk about the claims of Christianity, about the claims of the other people who had come down the line and pretended to be that they were the Messiah, they were the leader, they were God. And I was thinking, of course, of Zoroaster, or certainly one of the great religions of a previous time, 600 years before Christ came. Why Zoroaster was here and has tremendous following, actually, in Iran and other parts of the Middle East today. But why is Christianity different? Why is Christianity valid? Why can we put our hopes in the promises of the Bible? Because as things get worse, ladies and gentlemen, and they are going to get worse, I don't think the world's going to end on May 21st, as a lot of people are saying, and I think that's simply being done to discredit Christianity. But we are moving towards the climax of civilization. Jonathan, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you sort of pick up on this story there, and we'll just go along and certainly talk about the claims of Christianity, the claims of the other great religions of the world, and why Christianity is different and deserves our loyalty.
Yes, I think just to lay a background, Dr. Stan, it's good to look at the fact that in the very earliest times of history, all nations were aware of a promise of a coming Messiah. Now, in the beginning, we have in the book of Genesis the first prophecy given to mankind. This was after the fall in Eden, and the Lord came down and told the serpent, which Satan had used and which was to become a symbol of him, that a deliverer was coming. He was called the seed of the woman. He was coming down to fight the serpent, to defeat him, and to bring life, peace, and happiness back to mankind, and to restore everything that was lost.
And now, Chris, that has always been the hope of mankind, that the great time would come.
That is correct. And this was passed down from Adam and his wife to all their sons and their sons and their sons and daughters, and this became the most talked about promise to the human race. And then after the great flood, as mankind spread out, that memory was still fresh of this prophecy. This prophecy, by the way, preceded paganism with all its various religions by about 2,000 years, Dr. Stan, as you know. And not only was it known by the pagans, but nearly all Jewish commentators, with isolated exceptions, received this as real history and agreed that the prophecy was messianic in character. Now, Genesis 3:15 is the location of that prophecy for anyone who wants to check it up. But it's very, very interesting that the seed of the woman has been looked upon by a number of Jewish commentators as representing a promise of a virgin birth. And when we look at the old star maps, which were inherited by all the different nations, these star maps, by the way, go back to about 4000 BC. That you can count how old a road map is today. If you go to a road map of ancient, old North America, colonial time or pioneer time North America, you can identify whether it was in the 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th or the 20th century that the map was built, simply by the place names and where the various roads are and how other features are identified. Because maps do change over time, don't they?
They certainly do.
And on our sky maps, these maps were the same all around the world. And they had a common origin, there's no question about that. And because our solar system is moving all the time against the background of the stars, and because we know at the speed at which this is occurring, for example, our moon goes around the Earth once a month. Our Earth goes around the Sun once every 365 and a quarter days. And our Sun, with its planets, including our Earth, goes in a great circle, which, if we were to live long enough, it would take us 25,000 years to come back to the same place in relation to the what we can see in the starry background. And so by these star maps, we can orientate...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Yeah, sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Jonathan is simply talking about the star maps. And basically, of course, the ancient people always, of course, judged everything by the stars. And they were always astrologers or astronomers. And they were always looking at the stars. Man, from the very inception of recorded time, felt that there was something in the skies that, of course, would foretell the future. This was, of course, there were fundamental beliefs. There were certain things they knew and know, and they knew that the moon rotated around the Earth every 26 or 28 days, something like that. And they knew long before it was widely accepted that the sun did not rotate around the Earth, but the Earth rotated around the Sun. So, and then of course we have a specific place in the galaxy, and it takes every 26,000 years as we go in our relationship throughout the solar system to get back where we started. All of these things were known or suspected thousands of years ago. So pick up the story from there, Jonathan.
Yes, thank you. And we can date the early star maps by the position of the stars and the constellations in the sky as they're shown on these maps. One example is that the Southern Cross, which can now no longer be seen in the Northern Hemisphere, only in the Southern Hemisphere, was painted as a star group in the Northern Hemisphere. And we can tell its position and we can tell the dating of it. And there are quite a number of other parameters that we can use to indicate the age of these ancient star maps. Now, they go back to about 4,000 BC, about 6,000 years old. Now, that's very interesting because this goes back a couple of thousand years before the Great Flood. And it was after the Great Flood that paganism, as we know it, with all its different religions, rose.
And
now,
really
it's interesting also that when you consider some of these star groups, we take the one Virgo, for example, which means a virgin. Now, here's a constellation which is a picture of a woman, but not just any woman. She's a virgin. And it doesn't matter what language you go to, but the different star maps show the woman in all the Romans, the Hebrews, the Greeks, the Indians. They all show this woman, and they all call her virgin in their own language. Virgo by the Romans, Bethula by the Hebrews, Parthenos by the Greeks, Tanya by the Indians, and so on. Now, we might ask, why a virgin? Well, this is harking back to the original promise, the seed of the woman, not the seed of a man. And it's interesting that in this constellation Virgo, the brightest star is Spica, and that's a word which means seed, the seed of the woman. But the Hebrews called it Zera, which also means seed. So we might go through all the different various languages, each having similar star meanings.
And
so there we've got a global pattern of a single story known to all languages, recorded in all the constellations that were written on the sky map.
And I really think it's what is amazing is that in ancient times there was great knowledge, and certainly even before the flood, we think of it must have been pretty primitive then. Apparently, in many respects, it was very advanced knowledge, certainly for the first couple of thousand years of recorded history. And there was a commonality between all the different civilizations in all parts of the world, and the similarities between the Egyptian pyramids and the South American pyramids, the great knowledge that was known to the ancient Mayas and Aztecs and Incas, all of these things we don't have an explanation for, but we know it was there. And they had very advanced maps and very advanced knowledge. And, of course, the question is, how did they know, and what was the basis of that knowledge? And some of the engineering feats that were carried out, in ancient Egypt, and if you've ever been down the Nile and see those magnificent structures are there at Karnak and elsewhere. How did they do it? How were they able to move the stones for the great pyramids? You go to Jerusalem and you see those massive stones there in the wall that supports the Temple Mount. I mean, some of these, it's 25, 30 feet long, 20 feet high, 6 or 8 feet deep. How could you ever cut a stone like that in perfect symmetry and then move it into place? Could you go right ahead, Jonathan? There's this ancient knowledge that's always been there, but certainly we never stop and think about these things. So the great source of intelligence that existed long before modern civilization, that in many ways, of course, dwarfs what we know today. Please go ahead.
What you said is very, very true, and that's one of my favorite subjects, Dr. Stan, certainly is. These were not ignorant people. They were not superstitious people. These people were very enlightened. They were very cultured. They had tremendous technological and scientific knowledge. But along with that, they also had a single religion in the beginning, and that was a monotheistic religion based upon the promise of a coming deliverer. And when they drew their star maps, they put hieroglyphic pictures all across those star maps to record the promise that they were aware of, that was of this coming one. And the Virgo was just one of the pictures. Actually, there's 48 signs, not 12. It was later on that astrology came in and hijacked the signs, 12 of them. But even today, you ask any astrologer, what's the origin of these signs? They shake their head. They don't know. All they'll tell you is, well, if that's not important, main thing is, what do the stars tell you about your future? Well, that's their line. They cannot explain the origin of these things because they are older than paganism, older than astrology, and they have something very beautiful to tell us about a prophecy that was given to our first parents. And that was recorded on the star map. Now, the sequence is this. First of all, the prophecy of a coming Messiah was given. Then star names and symbols which survive to this day basically unchanged were invented and drawn across the maps of the sky to depict this prophecy of a coming Messiah. And by the way, they drew accurate maps of the world. They had a round world in their knowledge. It wasn't a flat earth to our earliest ancestors. We have 14 surviving maps of our planet that depict, that are based on a spherical projection. This shows they knew the shape, the correct size and shape of the earth. And they also knew the heavens. And as we draw maps up for the earth, they drew maps for the heavens. But upon these maps, they drew the prophecy of the coming Messiah. And that's a wonderful thing that's been forgotten. And today, when many Christian people try to shy off this because they think, well, we're getting into astrological stuff here. No, no, no. Satan is not an inventor. He's a counterfeiter. He only counterfeits something that already exists. And there already existed a promise of a coming one. That came long before the pagan messiahs that came later, which were revealed a little soon. Now, after the flood came the counterfeit. And we'll get into that shortly. But the thing to remember is that the imitations were of something that was already there, something that was already expected. And this is an astonishing story, Dr. Stan, because we've got a promised one, and then along comes somebody else and steals his identity. And it's a very, very bizarre story. It'd make a good Hollywood movie, but I think it'll be too explosive to be accepted.
Well, I think it's so important that people understand that certainly modern-day scientists deny the flood, or if it was a flood, they don't say it was the flood that we're told about with Noah. It said, well, yeah, well, there may have been a little flood someplace, but it wasn't a worldwide flood, and yet every civilization talks about this great flood, and this is in their tradition, and it's not simply a Jewish situation. We find this in the writings of every great civilization. They describe exactly the same flood, which of course separated the pre-flood society existence civilization from the civilization that developed after that. So please go right ahead.
That's correct, yes. It's important to understand that the whole world was awaiting this Messiah. It was not a Jewish thing at all. Even before there were any Jews, the world's oldest prophecy given to our first parents was handed down to all their descendants, the promise of a deliverer. And ultimately this permeated into the society of the spreading out populations. And so among the ancient Babylonians, the Persians, the Chinese, the Hindus, the Germans, the British, the Romans, Egyptians, and others, there was an expectation that this great one was coming to cure all ills. And he was to come from heaven for the purpose of delivering mankind. He would lay down his life once for all, but he would rise to life again and would ultimately bring a new world. That was how they understood this prophecy. In the process, he was going to be in conflict with the serpent and triumph over him. So this was known to the people back there. Now, one of the symbols of this coming one was a lamb or a ram. And that was written on the sky maps also. Very, very interesting thing. Now, Satan had taken captive this world, as we know. But would he just stand by and let this happen? Not on your life. Planet Earth was his territory now. And I'm sure that this rebel was certain that that God himself would not trouble himself over the loss of a few people on a tiny planet on the edge of the universe. But now he listens and he hears this promise that God is going to appear on Earth as a man. And this must have filled him with amazement and with fear. And he knew that he must do something to resist this. And so subsequent history becomes a history of moves and countermoves, and all of us are involved in this because our first parents involved us.
Of course, I think that story is being played out today. Most people don't recognize it, but that's the basis of everything taking place.
Yes.
Go right ahead, Jonathan.
And what I did mention was that there's a false view being taught out there today that religion was evolved slowly from superstition. That's nonsense. Archaeologically, it can be proven that there was originally one language and there was originally one God only worshipped. Monotheism was at the root of at the belief of every nation in the beginning. Doesn't matter whether you go to the Sumerians or the Phoenicians or the Egyptians or the Indians, they were all monotheists in the beginning. They recognized supremely one God. They knew that there was only one seed upon whom the hopes of the world were founded, and he was coming down to die. And interestingly, about the word Ashtar Zoroaster, in almost all nations, this god was known under the name Zero, or Zer, which means seed. Now, of course, the zero numeral is a circle, which is the shape of a seed. And names were very similar for this. Zero, or Zer, or Zoro. And the word Ashtar, or Ishtar, was the ancient name for woman. So he was the seed of the woman. But like, and so Zoroaster, or Zaroisha, was the origin of the name Zoroaster, which became polluted later, and we'll get into what it was meant to mean later on. But let's just lay our ground out first, that Zero meant seed, Ashtar meant woman. And the great God was coming down to become the seed of the woman. And that was the origin of that. It comes from the first prophecy, which is recorded in the book of Genesis. Okay. Now, it's interesting that there was this pure faith at the very, very beginning. And traces of the original language have been found in Australia, in North America, in Asia, in Africa. In fact, everywhere where archaeology has been able to find the traces of the one original language, it's identical all over the world. So the Bible story that there was one language is proven true by now by archaeology. And that's split up later on into many languages. There was one worship of God. And in Arizona some time ago, there were some descriptions deciphered. In fact, I know the guy who was involved in this, Gary Vay. And he confirmed that the original language was very much akin to the language of the Bible. Their words for God, their praising him and so on, was very much akin to what we see in the scriptures. So that was the original worship. It was the original religion, the worship of the true God. Now, when we go down to India, for example, we find the word Brahm, which means the one infinite and eternal God. Now, that's just a variation of the original Hebrew Ram, with the digama prefix, which is very frequent in Sanskrit words derived from Hebrew or Chaldean. The Hebrew Ram means the merciful or compassionate one. But Ram also means the womb or the bowels as a seat of compassion. And when we go to India, we find such language applied to Brahm. And there's no way of explaining this except that it comes from the original Hebrew Ram.
Hold that thought. Well, certainly, Jonathan's just talking about the similarities between all of the languages, and all of the languages that foretold that there would be this coming Messiah who would rule the world. And this was certainly not exclusively a Christian belief initially, because Christianity didn't even exist during the early days. But there was, certainly from the inception of recorded time, always a belief that the God would come to rule. So go ahead.
Yes. And so the Hindus, despite the deeply religious deterioration that we see today, once knew God as the God of mercy. They knew him as a just God and a rescuer. And he was also, in India, called the victim man. So that's very, very interesting. And you can trace by the languages the fact that they all came from an original language and that there was one God understood and that his son was coming down to die as a sacrifice. Now, as an example of how religion can deteriorate, we've got good archaeological evidence that the trend was to increase the number of gods as time passed rather than decrease them. It was only the later nations who became polytheists, that is, mean worshipping many gods. And if you just have to go to India as an example of how far this trend has developed over the past 4,000 years, it's calculated that today the Hindu religion, Dr. Stan, has as many, would you believe, as 600,000 gods.
Well, it is pretty ridiculous. I know there are an awful lot of them over there.
Yeah. Anyway, let's come down to the, we know that there was one central point. Human culture history is a single connected story. Everyone had a common source. There was a common language, a common religion, a common starting point after the flood, a common origin. And afterwards, they spread themselves out in detached bodies over the face of the earth. And there's good testimony to this effect in the ancient historians who recorded it as it was taking place. Now, when we get into the original split up here, the Bible records that soon after the flood, there was a departure from the location where the ark landed. And that in this departure, they were wishing to get away from the righteous Noah. Human nature was starting to become corrupted again. And so there was a move to go westward from the Ararat region. The book of Genesis says they came from the east and they found a great plain. Now, if you're coming from the east, what direction are you traveling? You're traveling toward the west, obviously. So if you look at the location of Noah's Ark up in the eastern mountains of Turkey, and you start traveling west, you'll notice there are two rivers that start in that region, and they first turn westward. The first of them is the Euphrates River, and the second is the Tigris. And they go westward for quite a distance, through the mountains, and then they both come out, side by side, with a short distance between them, upon a great wide plain. As soon as you leave the mountains, you have this great wide plain. And it's interesting that the book of Genesis says that they went from the east to a place where there was a great plain. And there they said, let's build us a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And this, of course, has become the infamous Tower of Babel. But the important thing is this, that the post-flood world was still in its infancy. Population increase was not yet an issue, so separation was not necessary nor desirable. And the rudiments of all future nations were still assembled together in one region at first. And so they agreed by common consent to build a city and a tower as a visible rallying point. And their stated purpose was to prevent their dispersion over the face of the earth. God said, get out and multiply and spread out over the earth. And they said, no, there's no need for us to do that. We're going to stay in this place. We're going to make ourselves a great name. And this becomes a very fascinating twist in history. Now, in these early centuries after the flood, there was one vexing problem. Vegetation was not yet established strongly, and wild animals were multiplying faster than people. And the rapid growth of the predators must have made life quite dangerous at first for these struggling populations. And along comes Nimrod, a great grandson of Noah. Now, we can estimate the population at this time from ancient records to be anywhere between 4,000 to 25,000 people. And as Nimrod organized bands of men to hunt down and kill those fierce marauding beasts, he established himself in their eyes as a mighty protector of the people. In this case,
hold that thought, please. Jonathan, you go right ahead. So you were just saying, of course, we have Nimrod. He's known as the great hunter. He's the great protector. He's going to protect the people as they stay here rather than disperse throughout the world and multiply as they've been told to by God. Please pick up the story.
Yes. So what we've got here is we've got animals, the wild beasts, competing for survival with the small human population. And Nimrod comes in. He starts to slaughter the wild animals and to emancipate the people from the fear of the wild animals. Now, if he had simply stopped at that and delivered the people from the fear of wild beasts, that would have been fine, I imagine. But when the forces of Satan enter the picture, events take a new twist, and here they see their chance to bring the whole population under their control. So the campaign is activated. Nimrod becomes the front man. Now, it's important to remember that the flood was fresh in the people's minds. And from research, we know that this was a major cosmic catastrophe. The book of Genesis tells us that anyway, but scientific research can confirm this. We believe there may have been anything up to 30,000 volcanoes belching forth dust, steam, boulders and lava during this event. And even as the flood subsided, volcanism continued to play havoc. And the thickening cloud cover deflected much of the solar heat away from the earth, and temperatures were cooler. And the weather remained wet, cold and miserable, largely without sunshine. And so Nimrod decides he's going to make himself a great name. He's already a hero. And he takes advantage of it. He says, look, you see, God's ruined the world. He's to blame for the flood. Now we've got to put up with all these dangerous beasts, freezing climate, little sun. What a monster the Creator is. I've had enough. Now, come out, follow me. I'll deliver you not just from the fear of wild beasts. I'll put protective walls around your community.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Jonathan is describing what the situation was following the flood when the grandson, great-grandson of Noah, a man named Nimrod, of course, was a great protector. There were lots of wild animals. The people were fearful of the animals. Nimrod organized the people to hunt down the animals so they could be safe, and then offered to obviously build this great Tower of Babel, and of course to build cities with walls around them. He was the protector of the people. And, of course, he was going to replace God, the God that had brought them to where they were. He was going to be the savior of the people. And, of course, Nimrod, in many ways, is sort of almost a prototype of the Antichrist. Would that be a fair appraisal of that, Jonathan?
Oh, very, very accurate, too, Dr. Stanby. And even the book of Revelation takes this up and calls the final Antichrist as being a symbol of Babylon. And, well, it all began with Nimrod, didn't it?
It sure did. And for our listeners, ladies and gentlemen, you might say, well, what does this have to do with anything today? It has everything to do with what's going on today. If you go to the city of Strasbourg, you will find there the building where, of course, the European Union meets. European Union is one of the foundation stones of this world government. And there is this building where, of course, the United Nations headquarters is situated, and it is a replica. of an incomplete building representing the incomplete Tower of Babel. These people who are leading the world today are simply picking up where Nimrod left off. But you're not supposed to understand any of this. This is never taught in our schools. You've never heard of the building there. You've never seen the pictures of the building in Strasbourg, but it's there, built as an incomplete building paralleling the incompleted Tower of Babel, which was never completed. But go right ahead, Jonathan. Perhaps before we do, maybe you would just like to get out to your information so people would know how they get your books, your DVDs. And we do carry one of the books that you've written, but of course the others, they have to come through you. How can people get in touch with you and get your fascinating information?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan. Yes. If they go to beforeus.com, it's www.beforeus.com, and scroll down near the bottom where it says click through to other products, they will find on the next page a book which is called Stolen Identity, and that tells the story that we're talking about today, Stolen Identity.
All right, fine. Will you go right ahead and pick the story up?
Now, okay, Nimrod, first of all, hunts down the wild animals. He delivers people from the fear of these beasts. Then he builds protective walls around their communities. Now, the first cities, as we wouldn't call them cities today, they're about as big as villages, but they called them cities then, of course. And he built walls around them. And those first walled cities, the walls were not to keep out enemies from the human standpoint, but keep out wild animals, to protect the people from the attacks of wild animals looking for food. And so here's Nimrod. The people are ready to listen to him. He says, look, I've got your interest at heart, so forget God. You can't even see him. Where does our warmth and our cheer come from? What brings life to our plants? What makes our food grow? Of course, it's the sun up there. If you want to honor something, I offer you the sun. And I can imagine a beam of sunshine breaking through the thick cloud cover and being welcomed with enthusiasm. Nimrod had them eating out of his hand. And so the seeds of sun worship were sown right there in Babylon. And through the sun symbol, Lucifer, or Satan. Now, Lucifer means day star. Well, indirectly, he was getting worship out of this himself. And this would have firmly established Satan ultimately as the god of planet Earth. Now, Nimrod was cultivating a reputation as the Mighty One. Now, one day he came in from the hunt, and he wore a band around the top of his head with two bull's horns sticking up from it. He had just subdued one of the wildest of the bulls. And so the horn became a well-known symbol for power and might and conquest. And so by degrees, the practice developed of calling Nimrod the Horned One. And he was the first we know of to wear on his head a band in which horns were set, symbolic of his power over the beast. And it's probably to this Kronos, which Kronos is a word which means Horned One in English, that we get the origin of present-day royal crowns. From Kronos we get the crown, a symbol of rulership. And the royal crown has its origin back there at the Tower of Babel with Nimrod. Now, up to this time, extended families looked to their eldest male as their leader, and that was a patriarchal system. Nimrod was the first to defy the patriarchal system and appoint himself over communities as ruler and king with a crown on his head. Now, it's interesting that in the Chaldean language, the same word that signified a bull also signified a ruler or a prince. And so the horned bull became to be a symbol of the mighty prince. A play on words. And this gives rise to the what we see on the sides of some of the Assyrian palaces of the horned man bull. Or the Indian counterpart, the sacred cow. Or the Egyptian sacred Apis bull. And this all originated, this symbolism, began with Nimrod and spread out as the nations dispersed. Now, it's interesting that Nimrod didn't have it all his way. There were still some people who were faithful. The line of Shem was still faithful to the true God. And Shem was alive still when this happened, and no doubt Shem had a lot of influence as a patriarch. And when Egypt was founded, it was monotheistic. And there's evidence that the Great Pyramid was not built by Egyptians, it was built by Semites. Egyptians themselves, in the Book of the Dead, intimate that Semites came into the country, and that the Great Pyramid was one of the structures they built. Now, that's a very interesting fact. Egypt originally was not pagan at all. It started out, like everybody did, as a worship of the true God. And Egypt played a role in Nimrod's demise. Now, first of all, the impressive tower was struck and reduced to ruin by God. And then, to make matters worse, the speech of his followers was suddenly confused, and groups began to uproot and move away. And I can imagine Nimrod and his group were in shock at that, but soon they revived, and they went after the closer scattered communities and promised to extend their protection to them. And so then after he had built more walled cities, and Genesis named some of these to protect the people, then by force of arms, using the men who had already been strengthened by fighting wild beasts, he began now to conquer the other community. And these brutal attacks extended as far as Libya against groups who still followed the way of God and were unskilled in war. But in Egypt, there were some who very persuasively withstood his flood of arrogance, and the aging Shem, so convinced a tribunal of 72 judges in Egypt of the enormity of Nimrod's offense that they pronounced the death sentence upon Nimrod. The book of Job alludes to the fact that to initiate sun worship and to go against God means that you sacrifice it, that you forfeit your right to be alive. And that was intimated in the book of Job. Now, Nimrod fled to the vicinity of modern-day Rome. It's rather interesting, the geographical history here. Nimrod, builder of Babylon, escaped for his life to a location where later on Rome would be built. But Rome, of course, did not exist at that time. Nimrod was caught. He was executed. Now, Nimrod's being cut down at the height of his glory was a great shock to his followers. And outwardly, it halted the sun worship that he had established. However, Nimrod had married a commoner by the name of Semiramis. She was considered to be one of the most beautiful women on earth. But you could say she was the pit. Perhaps no woman in history was ever more rotten than this one. And so the attention now comes to her. Understandably, no one was more deeply concerned about Nimrod's sudden death than she was. She had been elevated from a humble position. She had been raised to share with him the throne of Babel. So what was she to do? Would she just walk away from the pomp and pride that she had been raised up to enjoy? Of course she wouldn't. Although her husband's death had given a rude shock to her power, she had ambition. And now this ambition soared higher. Okay, in life, her husband had been honored as a hero. In death, she was determined to have him worshipped as a god. And if she played her cards right, instead of the public remembering Nimrod as a tyrant who had to be executed, she might persuade them to believe that he was a god who had sacrificed his life for the good of the people. And this is where the twist comes in. Now, I think it's good to remember that Semiramis had fallen under the control of Satan and his mob. And she was shown the moves that she needed to make. You know, behind world events, Dr. Stan, some of these events are too horrific and they're too long planning and too big in the historical scope to be just engineered by mortal men. There is a genius behind world events that is opposed to our God. And this genius is determined to perpetuate his rule upon this planet. And this is the genius of Lucifer or Satan. And they began to work through Semiramis. And the rumor that was now to be spread that Nimrod had fulfilled the prophecy of the coming one. a brilliant move. Well, wasn't he a hero? Hadn't he delivered mankind from the fear of wild beasts? Hadn't he gathered them together for safety into the first city? And hadn't he also delivered them from those spiritual relics of the flood disaster, those old cronies like Noah, Shem, and so on? And had not Nimrod been condemned by malicious judges in cahoots with Shem? Of course he had. And so Semiramis's husband, great hero that he was, had freely offered himself for the good of mankind. He was the sacrifice who had been promised. He was the coming one, the promised one. And we knew that the world was ready for this promise. They knew it was coming. It was going to be fulfilled sometime by a man who would do good deeds before his death. He would be born of the seed of a woman, not the seed of a man. And so a virgin birth was suggested. And the prophecy suggested that after his violent death, he would rise to triumph against his enemy. That was the essence of the prophecy. And so Semiramis would have Nimrod honored as that promised seed of the woman who had been prophesied to bruise the serpent's head, but who had to be in the process bruised in the foot, an expression which means he's temporarily put out of action. He'll die a violent death, but he'll rise again. Now, to have your head bruised, as the prophecy said Satan will be ultimately, would be the end of you. But on the other hand, if you're just bruised in the foot, you might be put out of action for a while, but you still can recover. Isn't that right?
It certainly is.
Yeah. So here's one of the most astonishing pieces of true history that we'll ever hear about. And if only it was taught in the schools, but boy, it's so explosive.
You know, basically, of course, you talk about Semiramis. Of course, she was known as the Whore of Babylon. And, of course, if you go up on the Internet, you'll find that some people already believe, of course, that the statue that stands in the harbor there in New York, the Statue of Liberty, was, of course, a replica of Semiramis. There's even a coin which was minted by the Vatican that shows a replica of of course, the Statue of Liberty with the beams on the head, and she's sitting rather than standing, but holding the torch, and of course, this marks Semiramis. So much of this fits together, but these are the parts of history that are never taught today.
They're never taught today, and I think it's good for us to know about them. Okay, so now let's create the rumor and get back the power. What a lovely idea, Semiramis thinks. And so with boldness, she makes the move. And this is what she says. Nimrod's spirit has ascended to the sun. And then came the punchline. A beam from the sun has impregnated me in the womb. So here we have Semiramis brazenly claiming to be still a virgin. And so when a male child was born to her, she asserts that the baby is the promised deliverer. That actually her dead husband, reborn, has come back to defeat his enemies. A very smooth move. And her child she named Tammuz. And his birth date was December 25. Okay. So now, let's see what's happened up till now. From hunting down animals, Nimrod turned to hunting down defenseless people. And his defiant and corrupt worship system was open and public. His death was not that of a warrior slain in battle, but it was a judicial act solemnly inflicted by a court. Interestingly, Nimrod's dismembered limbs were sent to the chief cities that were following his system, and his sun worship cult was outlawed. But now, let's hold our breath on this one. Here's beautiful Semiramis. She's no idiot. She realizes that to revive Nimrod's system publicly is out of the question. The pure patriarchal faith is still fresh in the minds of many people, and Shem, Noah's son, is still alive to rouse and rally the faithful, and this makes open sun worship hazardous. Okay, then, extreme caution has to be used. If her power over the people is to be recovered, if the dead hero is to be elevated to the status of a god, the process will need to begin secretly. And then only after she's gained enough supporters will it be safe to re-establish Nimrod's paganism openly. So the next step is to go undercover so that the forbidden things are represented in public by something that's acceptable, but to the initiated, there's another meaning. So it's a double meaning.
Now, is this then the origin of the mystery religions and the secret societies?
Yes, this is exactly the origin of it.
And I think it's so important, ladies and gentlemen, for you to understand that these mystery religions and secret societies date back to that time of Nimrod. Basically, of course, Jonathan and I hadn't talked about this before, but I've been studying this for many years, and he verbalizes this so well. We do not understand the origins of so many of the movements which are present today, but they date back to that time of ancient lore, and it all gets around to the worship of the sun, this mysterious power that you can tap into, and of course you'll get a great power on your own, but of course you certainly don't want to access this, because of course it's in total violation of God's law, but there is power that you can tap into. It's not imaginary, but there are people who have done this. They've been very, very successful. We could name some of them today, very, very famous. But it's amazing how they all die very young and lead tragic, tragic lives. We'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan Gray as we continue this expose of the great secrets. Go right ahead, Jonathan. We've got three more minutes in this segment, and then we'll get to the next segment. Fascinating material.
Okay, very good. Okay, so what's going to happen next? Well, we know what happened. They went undercover so that the forbidden things were represented in public by something else. Double meanings. And to this harlot rescue came a high-powered religious think tank. The priest of Nimrod that he had set up, in return for Semiramis's favors, brainstormed what was to become known as the mysteries, as you suggested, Dr. Stan. That's exactly how this came about. And under the seal of secrecy and the sanction of an oath, and by means of all the resources of witchcraft, tricks, and magic, Nimrod's sympathizers were gradually enticed back to the outlawed system. Now, it's very, very interesting that in Egypt, for example, they set up a temple in Egypt, and their followers there were brought into the temple, and they had what we today would call a movie camera set up. And this is recorded in Egyptian history, and it was like a television camera that came close to the screen and then moved further back, and as it moved, the face of Nimrod would appear on the screen in the dark, all the lights were out, And the worshippers would with awe see his face grow bigger and bigger and bigger in the darkness. And then they'd hear words that were coming out of the darkness saying, "Don't fear, my children." First of all, there were a lot of frightening things went on in the dark. And then came the face of Nimrod as the soother or the comforter. And he'd say, "Don't fear, my children. I'm here to help you. Just do what I say." And the priest would give instructions over some kind of loudspeaker. And the people would be whipped up into an ecstasy of excitement, and gradually they became to love Nimrod through means like this. But first of all, they were frightened and scared by the tricks of the priests, and then in the same ceremony, Nimrod would come to comfort them and take away their fears. And by tricks like these, people who were afraid to worship him in open continued to develop a love and the following after Nimrod in secrecy. Very, very interesting. And under numerous hidden symbols, the sun cult was resumed. Now, those who were initiated would know that they were in reality worshipping the forbidden things under these new symbols, that the outsider would never know. It would be a mystery to him. Let me give a couple of examples. Now, in the Babylonian mysteries, they named their sun god Bel.
I'm going to hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly you'll probably want to get a copy of these tapes. We may very well put them out as tape of the month. We'll have to see, but or you can get them separately. There will be another hour here, and it sounds to me like we're going to have to do another couple of hours even after the second hour tonight, because this is information that is fundamental to understanding how everything fits together today. But there really are mystery religions out there, ladies and gentlemen. They've been around for thousands of years. You only need to read the writings of Manly P. Hall. and is the secret destiny of the United States. Manly Pigalle was a leading occultist of the last century. We carry many of his books, his book on the secret destiny of the United States, the Lost Keys of Freemasonry, secret teachings of all ages. They're available through my ministry. Not that we advocate them. We don't put them on a regular catalog. They're in a research catalog for people who are researchers. Now, this gives you a key to understanding what's going on, but we don't want you to think at all that this is the message you should be following, because it is not. But if you want to understand that suddenly we're involved in a spiritual battle, and there really are forces on the other side, not imaginary, well-organized, well-financed. Some of the wealthiest people in the world have been and are today involved in this, and some of the wealthiest families. Now, if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't heard our talk on the Forbidden Secret and on the Dark Secret and read the syllabus as you go with this, it will give you tremendous insight into an understanding of what's going on today. But in the final analysis, of course, the solution is very simple. It's a very simple story, the story of Jesus and, of course, his promise for humanity and the difficult times that lie ahead. And there are difficult times that lie ahead. Why, this is what you're going to need to cling to. So if you'd like to get the writings that I just spoke of, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You'd like to get those books written by Manly Pigalle, who talks about how this has all been known for thousands of years. And what is their goal? A one-world religion. Democracies is association of democracies throughout the world. Well, democracy is simply Satan's world for an authoritarian society into his control, because as Plato pointed out so well, democracies always degenerate into despotism. The people always vote for the man who promises to give them the most, and then, of course, you centralize power. And the people of great wealth then, of course, control the politicians, just like they do in Washington, D.C. today, where we have the finest politicians money could buy. All you need to do is serve one term in Congress. You'll get your salary for the rest of your life. They exclude themselves from the laws that affect the rest of us. They're excluded from the Obama health care bill. They're not going to be under that inferior type of a health care system, where, of course, a board in Washington, D.C., who can determine, without even knowing who you are, just depending upon your age, who lives and who dies. But don't have to worry, ladies and gentlemen. Congress is excluded. Well, of course, it is this corruption. This is this so-called democratic society that we have, where the leaders are rewarded by the people who really rule behind the scenes. And many of these people have given themselves over to what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. We are truly involved in a spiritual battle between the forces of light, the forces of darkness. They've been around for thousands and thousands of years. It's not imaginary, but we are, well, in some ways blessed to live in the most exciting time in history. You can see the crescendo of crises increasing all throughout the world today. But do not despair. Understand the spiritual nature of what's going on. And, of course, if you do not have a personal relationship with our Lord, I think you should give very, very serious consideration to evaluating the promises of the Bible. Because as things grow worse, and I can promise you one thing, they are going to grow worse. You're going to need that support for survival. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest this evening, Jonathan Gray, and you can tell from his accent he's from an English-speaking country. He's actually residing in New Zealand at the present time. Jonathan, if you don't know his background, has had a fascinating life, travels, of course, studying archaeology, and, of course, he has the advantage of not working for a major university, so he can tell you the truth. If you work for a major university and you tell the truth about evolution or about Christianity, why, they will make your life miserable. Fortunately, Jonathan has a great deal of material, and certainly we've bought much of this. Gives us a background, and you may very well want to get this material from him. We'll tell you later how to do it. But Jonathan is simply giving us the background of the mystery religions and the secret societies which dominate and have dominated history for the last 4,000 years. Jonathan, pick the story up.
Yes. It's interesting that when we look at the Babylonian mysteries, I'll give a few examples of the double meanings. They're very, very clever, these are. The choice of them was really imaginative. Now, in the mysteries, they would name their sun god Bel. In English, we'd say that B-E-L. Because in their language, the word bell had two meanings. It had a double meaning. In English, we have certain words that have double meanings, don't we? Well, they picked out words in their language that had double meanings. The word bell meant, it could mean either heart, that's the heart that beats in your body, or the sun that shines in the sky. Now remember, the mysteries were founded upon sun worship. So bell was a very appropriate word with a double meaning that could be used so that the initiates would know they were worshipping the sun, but to the inquirer on the outside who saw the symbol of bell, they would be told that this is simply the sacred and loving heart of the coming Saviour. So the devotees knew that they were could not openly raise up images of the sun. That would be too obvious. So in the double talk of the mysteries, they decided on the symbol of the sun under the cover of a heart shape to represent their worship. And they put little flames around the heart so that it would be like a tongue-in-cheek daring of the public to guess what they were really worshipping. Here was the sacred heart with little flames around it, and it's the same word, bell. But you say sun, it's bell. You say heart, it's bell. And so the sneaky part was that when the outsider questioned their use of the heart symbol in their worship, he was led to believe that the devotees were simply acknowledging the loving heart of the coming Messiah. Smooth talk. But these devotees knew it was not bell as heart that they were worshipping, but bell as the sun. And to cryptically indicate this, they carved flames of the sun to encircle their sacred heart images. Do we see that in use today still? The sacred heart with the flames around it being worn around people's necks? It's interesting.
Well, and because they have their symbols, they hide their symbols in plain sight. I mean, there are literally dozens of these occult emblems. We see them every day. We don't recognize them, but they do. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. So there's one explanation for the initiate and another explanation for the outsider. Now, here's another example of it. You have the circle of the sun seen at the tip of Vishnu's finger in India. Now, that's an example that we can use because you may have seen some of these pictures of the Indian gods, and you'll see a circle of the sun at the tip of Vishnu's finger. You'll also see on priests often the circular tonsure. In other words, that there's a circular place on the top of their head that is cut bald to represent, to imitate the solar disk, the disk of the sun. And this symbol was used by the priests of Babylon to indicate that they were priests of the sun. But to anyone who asks them what's that circle for, they'd say the circle is the seed, to show that we believe in the seed of the woman that's coming. So the circle of the sun was a worship of the sun, but and imitating the solar disk, but explained to outsiders as the seed of the woman prophecy of the coming Messiah who was yet to come. So
hold
the outsider
that
was not
hold
told
that
what
thought.
Was really going on.
Go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes, okay. Semiramis was such a shrewd girl, and she was to become the great mother of this religion. And it's interesting that in the great scattering which ultimately occurred from Nimrod's Babel Center, this single religious system was carried by the dispersing tribes to the very ends of the earth. And so around the world, various religions arose with the same Christ story. Now, when you make a careful study of these Christ legends in all the different countries of paganism, the points of similarity do show a common origin for them. There's compelling evidence that these many Christs of legend are, in fact, one and the same person. These many Christs are Nimrod himself. They're Semiramis's parody that she gave of the promised Saviour. Now, we noticed that a bit earlier in our broadcast that the first prophecy concerning the coming Christ could be traced back as early as 4000 BC. But when we trace the Christ of paganism, they only go back to around 2200 BC, which gives us the location of Babel in history, in Mesopotamia. And it is to the event which occurred there that the religions of ancient Babylon, Egypt, India, the Maya, and others owe their Christ. They simply mimic the promise of the deliverer who was to come, but they're really worshipping the Nimrod himself who came from the sun. And so a Messiah was worshipped in the pagan mysteries, but it was the worship of a bogus Messiah, the rebel Nimrod, and ultimately also his wife. Now, in setting her husband up as the counterfeit Messiah, she used secret, mysterious symbols to represent him so he could be worshipped as a god, safely. And although this kind of deceit was considered necessary at first, eventually the worship became more popular and became widespread and more open. And when it was powerful enough to take over a nation, it was pursued blatantly with no risk, and images of the sun then began to appear openly all over the world. So Semiramis had pulled off something mighty, a miserable caricature of the truth, and Nimrod's blasphemous travesty of what was right was up and running around the world. But there was a price to pay for joining it. Members had to tell Semiramis' priest everything they'd ever done wrong, and that was called the confessional.
And hold that thought, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Chris Zonin. We're just saying that those people who embrace this faulty religion, this false religion, the religion of Nimrod worship or sun worship, suddenly were required to make certain confessionals. In other words, they would have to tell, if during the time when Semiramis was still living, they would have to tell her everything they'd ever done that was wrong, because that would give her a hold over them. Just as today, for instance, if you join certain of the secret societies, like the one at Yale University, Skull and Bones, you have to tell all of your sexual exploits to the people there within your small 15-member group so that they will have a hold over you. And the similarities between all of this is very, very similar. In fact, all of the secret societies use certain very similar techniques to control their members, and many times these members become the rulers of great nations. But go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes, and after telling all in the confessional, the followers would be scared stiff that the priest might expose them, and so this way the mother of harlots maintained control of the people with an iron fist. Well, you might wonder, how did she pull this off? Well, I think of four things that helped Queen Semiramis. One was Nimrod's popularity before he died. Another was the desire of the people to keep him in their memory. And thirdly, Semiramis's extraordinary beauty. It's stated that on one occasion, when her subjects were very upset about something and came around the palace, she just simply came out onto the balcony and her beauty calmed them down. They just could not speak against her when they saw how beautiful she was. That was in her favour, her physical beauty. And the fourth thing that I would suggest helped her success was that many kings had become subservient through Nimrod's conquest, and she went to one of them after another, offering her sexual favours to them, and in return they furthered her self-conceived counterfeit system of religion, which gradually spread out to the ends of the earth. This is why every pagan religion in every country on this planet, from South America to Japan, carries identical symbols and festivals to a very marked extent, even to this day. What a woman. And here she is. She lived 4,000 years ago, and her influence still goes on around the world.
And, of course, that's why she was known as the Whore of Babylon. Go ahead.
Sure thing, yeah. And so Satan makes black look white, so you can hardly tell the difference between the fake and the real. That's how counterfeiters work. And human nature being as it is, statues appeared of Semiramis holding her husband's son, Nimrod, as the sun god, and the halo around his head indicated his asserted relationship with the sun, the physical sun in the sky. Now, at first, there was no intention for the mother herself to be adored. She was used chiefly as a pedestal for the upholding of her divine son, to present him for adoration by the people. But that which appeals to the senses must make the most powerful impression. And according to the records, the sunburnt Nimrod was not a beautiful man, but the physical beauty of Semiramis was legendary. And sometime after her death, there was a statue erected in her honor. And then that ultimately evolved, if I don't like the word evolved, but it ultimately developed to become a worship of the woman as well as the man in different countries. And she was worshipped under the names, depending upon which country the worship was in, as Isis or Venus or Aphrodite and so on. In China, she was called Xing Mu, which means Holy Mother of China.
Diana was the Diana.
Diana.
Right.
The Huntress. Diana the Huntress, wife of the famous hunter. Yeah. In Phoenicia, she was called Ashtaroth. And as Diana, she sported a tiered Tower of Babel headpiece on her head. And one of her names was, another name was Astarte, or Ishtar. Ishtar actually means woman. We get the word Easter from the word Ishtar. And it comes from the worship of Semiramis. Incidentally, the festival of Ishtar was 9 months before the festival of Nimrod's birth on December 25. So March, it takes us back to about March, and that was the 9 months of conception that she had the child in her body. And very interesting. And her devotees would bake cakes to her with the cross symbol, the cross representing the teeth of Tammuz, her child, stamped on the cakes. And the Queen of Heaven became a very popular title for her. It's referred to in the book of Jeremiah. And as the tribes scattered out from the Mesopotamian region, they carried to the ends of the earth this belief system of Nimrod. Each one had the same fake Messiah child in his mother's arms under different names, depending on the language. So Nimrod became known as Baal, or Bacchus, or Saturn, or Osiris, or Adonis, or Tammuz, or Saturn, or Horus, wherever. And this was developed into a promiscuous and a sadistic system that appealed to the basis of human intellect. And that was the secret of its success. And like a virus, it took over the world, and it survives in the different pagan religions to this day. Okay. Now, just notice how subtle this was. In Egypt, one of Nimrod's titles was Osiris. Now, Osiris was mystically concealed by being represented under the form of a young bull or a calf. When they made a statue of Osiris, they made a statue of a bull. And that was sometimes called Apis, because the word Apis means to cover or conceal. And so Apis bulls represented the hidden one. In other words, the double-meaning one, the one who's hidden under mysterious symbols in the mystery. And the bull was one of the wild beasts, of course, that Nimrod the hunter had subdued. So it was an appropriate symbol to represent, and the language, Apis, representing the bull, also meant the one who's hidden under symbols. The worship of the outlawed Nimrod, hidden from all who except were initiated into the mystery. Well, we keep going on that part of it. He was also called the Lamented One. And they had a 40-day feast before the festival of Ishtar to mourn over his death. And then Ishtar comes along and he is conceived. A beam from the sun comes down into Semiramis and he is conceived. So the mourning took place for 40 days, the crying out and lamenting of his death, followed by his conception from the sun into the body of Semiramis, and then his birth 9 months later on December 25. All this was worshipped in this way by these people. Now, it's interesting that Semiramis later on came to be identified with Eve. She came to be called the mother of all living ones, just like Eve. And she is the mother of all of the regenerate ones, they said, the ones who have been born through the sacrifice of Nimrod. She becomes the mother of all. And so her role as the mother of mankind identifies her with Eve in the minds of the worshippers. The mother of the gods, the mother of all deified mortals, the originator or the mother of the mystery religion that deified good dead men. And in the pagan mysteries, one of Eve's names was Rhea. And Rhea, in the active sense, means the gazing woman because she gazed on the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But Rhea, in the passive sense, means the woman gazed at, that is, the beautiful woman. And in this connection, we recall that Nimrod's wife was famous for being gazed at. And so Eve, the gazing woman, was linked with Semiramis, the woman gazed at. And so the two were amalgamated in the pagan mystery. Now, the Phoenicians explained that Rhea, the gazing woman, through contact with Cronos, that's Satan, brought forth a son who was called Death. And this linked the mother of gods and men with Mother Eve. It was as the gazer upon the forbidden fruit that the mother of mankind conceived by Satan a deadly birth. And that deadly birth was death, because death came by her uniting her heart with that of Satan. And through the eyes of these worshippers, Satan was looked upon as, the serpent's name was Nahash, or Nashash, as it stands in the Hebrew of the Old Testament, and that means to view attentively, or to gaze. It's very interesting. And that reminds me of Genesis, is it chapter 3, verse 6, says that when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and pleasant to the eyes she took. So here's the pedigree of rebellion and death. As it says in the New Testament, lust, when it hath conceived, brought forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brought forth death. So among the Phoenicians, the son of Rhea came to be called the god of death. And a vulture, in Egypt, a vulture became the symbol. The Egyptian mort, or mut, or mu, was symbolized either by a vulture or an eye. An all-seeing eye surrounded by vulture's wings. So under the name of Mort or Mu, which means mother, the mother's distinguishing decoration was the vulture headdress on the Egyptian statue. So we see Mort wearing a vulture on her head. And the eye surrounded by a vulture's wings showed that the great mother in Egypt was known as the gazer. She was clearly borrowed from Babylon, where the name Rhea signifies both a gazing woman and a vulture. And it's got a double meaning there in Babylon, a gazing woman or a vulture.
And I think it's really so interesting that the eye has always been the symbol of the mystery religions. You'll notice on the CBS when they will watch the screen and CBS comes on, CBS television down there in the right lower quadrant, is the emblem of the eye. They understand what this is about. It is simply they laugh at the stupidity of the average individual. You see, they hide their emblems in plain sight. You see them every day, and you don't recognize them. We have a section on our website, RadioLiberty.com, on occult symbols and emblems. They're there, they're prominent, and they're invisible to the average individual, incapable of seeing them. Jonathan, go right ahead.
Yes, sure. Okay, now getting back to the force behind all this, Lucifer, Satan, Prince of Earth. Lucifer means day star, that is, the sun, the star that shines in the daytime. And as we've noted from the very beginning, the attitude of Lucifer's group is toward the human race is one of jealousy, hatred, and sadism. Satan himself is obsessed with a fanatical passion that we should honor him instead of honoring our Maker. And yet, when we go to the how could he get himself worshipped direct? Because it seemed that everyone feared and despised Satan. Well, it wasn't such a difficult solution when you think about it. Here's how he did it. We'll find the key in the original messianic prophecy in the Bible. The whole world knew that a coming deliverer was going to destroy Lucifer finally. And this expected Messiah in the earliest times was associated with the bringing of spiritual light into the dark hearts of fallen men and women. So now let's fast forward from the Garden of Eden to the time of Nimrod. In those miserable climatic conditions following the flood, the sun soon came to be looked upon with special regard. Now, combine that with a desire for physical images of the deity, and it was a simple matter to begin making physical images of the sun. And thus, under the influence of Nimrod, sun worship was instituted at first with comparable ease. Now, Nimrod had some crafty theologians, and they began twisting and turning, and whereas the expected Messiah in the earliest times was associated with the bringing of spiritual light, this symbolic meaning was now insidiously displaced by actuality, if you want to call it that, physical light represented by the sun. And it began at Babel. And when the people were dispersed over the earth, they took it with them. And so all over this planet, there began to arise sun plates, sun pillars, and so on, and the smoke of strange altars ascended in honor of the sun god at sunrise. And the sun god became the highest god, and he was given, the first day of the week was given his name, and some people think that the worship of the sun and the heavenly bodies is an innocent thing into which people might have fallen naturally and excusably fallen. But I think we ought to get real about this. This was a blatant deception. Just watch how it happened. In the original language, the sun was called Shemesh. Now, that's the worldwide name for the sun before the Babel rebellion, Shemesh. Now, what does Shemesh mean? Shemesh means servant. That's important to bear in mind. The sun was at first called Shemesh, which means servant. And we might suspect that this name was originally given to keep the world in mind of the great truth that however glorious is the sun, it is, after all, no more than a servant of mankind. It's not something to be worshipped. And so Earth's inhabitants looked into the sky, and in the first tongue of mankind, they called it Shemesh, the servant. Now came Nimrod with his conspiracy, which consciously put the servant in the place of the unseen master, the creator. And they twisted it to call the sun Baal. Now, the word Baal means Lord.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, what John is bringing out, of course, is really very important. And that is, of course, initially why the sun was looked upon as a servant of mankind. But suddenly, under Nimrod's concept, why, of course, the sun became God himself. I mean, the sun provides us heat and certainly allows us to grow crops. And without the sun, life would be very, very miserable. In fact, there would be no life. But suddenly, under Nimrod's way of thinking, the sun became equated with God, and it became the center of worship in the ancient societies, having lost sight of the one true God from who created the heavens and the earth and the sun, and all to work together in worship of him. Now suddenly we substitute the sun, and of course we call that Baal. But go ahead.
Yes, and can you imagine, Dr. Stan, a change of name being more deliberate? And this can be no accident. We've got the sun being called the servant. Then lo and behold, Nimrod says, no, we'll call it the Lord. We'll call it our master, the supreme master. Totally opposite in meaning. And so the centuries rolled on. And at dawn services from Asia to Europe to South America, royal families, nobles and common people stood silent and still, their eyes turned toward the east, awaiting the great moment when the first brilliant rays would shine over the horizon. And in some countries, a human image representing the sun was worshipped by casting live children into the fire in its belly. And who was behind this devilish development? Who was manipulating the human race into such degradation? Well, we don't have to guess. If we go to the remotest archaeological sites on Earth, the most consistent symbol I have found in all my archaeological work, apart from the symbol of the sun, is the symbol of the serpent, the snake. Sun worship and serpent worship went together. And guess whose trademark both of these are? The serpent is universally the symbol of the sun throughout pagan mythology. And if we take Egypt as an example, one of the common symbols of the sun or the sun god is a disc with a serpent around it, and pharaohs used to wear that on the front of their heads. A sun disc with a serpent around it. And this all goes back, of course, to the beginning of time when the promise of a coming one was given and the divine curse was placed on Satan, the serpent. Now, because a serpent was the original medium Satan used to turn our first parents against the Creator, the snake was now Satan's special emblem. So we shouldn't be surprised when we find that the fallen ones deliberately planned for snake worship to feature at the top of this bogus religion they were setting up for mankind to follow. Now, people naturally feared the serpent. They even hated it. No matter, just get that symbol first into the worship. That's the first stage. Nimrod's priests were already saying that the great flood had proceeded from the evil principle. In other words, the unseen god was the evil principle. So now the great serpent, the evil principle, became the symbol of the flood. Now watch how this falls into place. First of all, all the races of mankind had the knowledge that Satan had been banished from heaven. And this was known worldwide. And his angels were known by the Greeks as Titans. They were known in the Chaldean system under the symbol of Typhon. Now, Typhon is the serpent, or the dragon, who was universally regarded as the devil by all nations. Now, in the mysteries, an important change took place as soon as the way was paved for it. First of all, Tammuz, the Merimus' son, was worshipped as the promised deliverer, the bruiser of the serpent's head. This meant that ultimately he was going to destroy Satan's kingdom. And so it was that the Greeks ultimately represent their great god Apollo as slaying the serpent Pytho. And they represent Hercules as strangling serpents while he was in his cradle. And whether we go to Scandinavia or Mexico or Egypt or India, we find clear allusions to the same truth. But then in Egypt, the child god Horus, who is known as the seed, is seen standing on the head of a crocodile and bruising serpents in his hand. So we find that the evil genius is always figured in the form of a snake or a serpent who's going to be crushed by the coming deliverer. Okay? You'll find this in India. You'll find it in all the ancient religions. Now we come to the clever twist. This is how Satan gets from being the despised one to the revered one. The priest said to the people, "Give the serpent a measure of respect to console him for the loss of his power and to prevent him from hurting you."
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Grateful for a land so fair.
Well, Jonathan, Chris, the problem is, how do you get people to believe a lie? And so many people today believe the lie. It has been told over and over and again in one form or another. So how is it told in ancient times?
All right, this is what they do. They start off by looking at the serpent as a symbol of the evil principle, and they end up by representing him as a symbol of the good principle. How do they do that twist? All right, first of all, they told the people that the serpent was losing his power, so we've got to console him. We've got to prevent him from hurting us. So let's respect him. So that was the first step. We don't like him, so now let's respect him. Now, a logical follow-through was now to link the sun and the serpent together. And here was the reason that they gave, that as the sun was the great enlightener of the physical world and makes everything grow, so the serpent was the great enlightener of the spiritual. Why? Simply because the serpent gave mankind the knowledge of good and evil, and for that he deserves our respect. And we have become enlightened to all the good things that the unseen God wants to conceal from us. And so the introduction of the serpent into the mysteries as the great enlightener was no innocent accident. On the part of the priests, it was nothing less than a deliberate and daring perversion of what they knew to be true. That reminds me of that statement in the book of Romans by Paul. It says, when they knew God, see, they did know him. When they knew God, they glorified him not as God and changed the glory of God into an image made like to corruptible man, and into creeping things. Now that's snakes. It shows that the Bible itself, Paul himself tells us, they knew God, they changed the glory of God into an image of snakes. Is that an ignorant move? No, quite the opposite. And finally, this serpent worship became the supreme object of worship. The dragon, the serpent, and it began to occupy right next to the sun the important place.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. And first, Jonathan just talked about the importance of the serpent. Certainly the sun. The sun gave us life. The sand gave us heat. We needed to worship the sun. But, of course, we also the serpent. And the serpent, certainly as a physician, when I was in the medical corps, I wore the caduceus. And what is the caduceus? Why, it's a cross with two serpents wrapped around it, the emblem of healing, of knowledge, of the emblem of medicine. And, of course, you always sort of wonder, well, of course, we're not going to bother to ask why the symbol of modern medicine is a caduceus, a cross with two serpents intertwined, wrapped around it. It's just always been that way. It must be healthy. It must be good. After all, everybody acknowledges that, or... is it healthy? Is there a pagan significance to this emblem? Of course there is. But, of course, how many doctors, and I among them, I shall have to admit, have ever stopped and wondered why this is the symbol of the healing offered by physicians to people throughout the world? All of these emblems hidden in plain sight, and we never see them. Go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes. Well, talk about a scheme to fool the people. Now I take it a step further. In connection with the symbol of the serpent, fire worship is introduced. And so we have sun, fire, and serpent worship all tied together. Now, in the divine prophecy given to our first parents, the promised deliverer was called the seed of the woman, right? Now comes the twist. In the Babylonian language, seed was the word zero, which comes from the root word zer, which means to encompass. But zero also signified a circle. Now, as we've already noted, the genius of the mysteries was largely founded on double meanings. So when Tammuz, the counterfeit Messiah, came to be asserted as the prophesied seed of the woman, that's zero, he was regarded as the sun, S-U-N, in human flesh. And a circle was the emblem of the sun. So the seed now becomes the sun. It's the same word, zero, the seed, the sun. But that's not all. the word Ashtar signified woman. But Ashtar had a double meaning. In the Babylonian language, Ashtar also signified fire. So in the double talk of the mysteries, Zero Ashtar, which was seed of the woman, referring to the coming true Messiah, came to be rendered the seed of fire. Seed of the woman, seed of fire. Now, did the priests know what they were doing? Of course they did. Fire was regarded as the earthly representation of a fiery sun, and the name Zero Ashtar, seed of the woman, was willfully perverted by the priests. And when the original promise of the coming Messiah began to be forgotten, the meaning of the term Zero Ashtar, seed of the woman, was lost to all who knew only the doctrine of paganism, and it was called the seed of fire. In other words, the seed, the child who came from the sun. That was the only meaning, fire worship now. And so ultimately, Zero Ashtar, seed of the woman, became Zoroaster, the well-known name of the head of the fire worshippers of Persia. So there was a Zoroaster long before the well-known Zoroaster of Persian times, and this title was originally applied to Nimrod, the man who founded sun and fire worship.
And that is then the founder of the Zoroastrian religion.
That's right.
Okay.
A sneaky transformation. And so the sun, rather the snake, had now come to represent the good principle, a very, very clever twist. And as such, it was sometimes depicted as a winged angel. Hence, snake worship depicting the form of the snake was blended with angel symbols. And true to the character of the mysteries, the male serpent came to typify the Great Father, whilst the female serpent typified the Great Mother. And snake cults spread worldwide. So the Egyptian pharaohs would call themselves sons of the sun god, and they displayed a serpent on their headdress. You'll see that on a statue of Tutankhamun and some of the others, the serpent on their headdress. And both the sun and the serpent were worshipped together. The sun because it gives physical light to the earth, and the serpent, as we mentioned before, because he was the great benefactor of mankind who brought spiritual light, the knowledge of good and evil. And under the form of the sun divinity, in Rome, was worshipped Satan under the name of Aesculapius. That means the man instructing serpent, the serpent who instructs mankind. And so Satan, the rebel banished from heaven, had instructed our first parents to defy their maker, and here at last now Satan himself is being worshipped as the great man instructing serpent, man's benefactor. What a twist. Now, it's interesting that it doesn't matter where you go in paganism, you talk about the serpent, it's the same symbol, the same god as the sun. Serpent and sun are the same. And according to the fundamental law of the mysteries, as brought from Pergamos, now that when Babylon was destroyed, the priests of the soldiers of Babylon fled to Tibet and established the same religion in Tibet. The priests of Babylon went west to Pergamos in Asia Minor with their images of the sun as the only one god, and then that was brought to Rome, from Pergamos to Rome. Now, in the book of Revelation, the headquarters of this worship was in Pergamos at the time John wrote the book of Revelation. He said Pergamos is the place where Satan's seat is. But later on, this seat was moved to the city of Rome. And so Titan, or Satan, had become the one only god, and Tammuz, under the role of Janus, in his role as the sun, or the woman's seed, was just an incarnation of the same god. So the secret's out. The real name of the supreme god of the Roman Empire was Satan. Satan worship was the secret purpose of the mysteries. I mean, Satan was manipulating all this because he wanted mankind to worship him. Through Nimrod it started, and it ends up as a hidden worship of Satan. That's the very region of Lucifer's efforts, was to set up the mysteries to get himself worshipped openly in secret, as you like to put it. Now, the secret was most jealously guarded at first, so much so that when one of the most learned of the Romans, the high-ranking Valerius Serranus, divulged it incautiously, he was mercilessly put to death. And eventually Satan was regarded with awe and dread under the name of Pluto, the god of the underworld, because he's the great god on whom every person's destiny depends. It belongs to him to purify souls after death in his purgatory. So that's why the serpent came to be worshipped. People were afraid not to worship him because he was the judge when they died. And to claim that one had been born as the serpent's seed potentially attracted great honour to him. So we have Olympias, the mother of Alexander the Great, declaring that her son had not sprung from King Philip, her husband, but from Jupiter in the form of a serpent. And then we have the Roman Emperor Augustus pretending that he had issued from Apollo in the form of a serpent. So Satan was now the prince of this world, ruling the leaders of the world, and he was its god. And he is still the god of the leaders of this world. Still here.
I have no question at all that so much of what's going on today is truly satanic as we prepare ourselves for another great world war. You can see this all coming together. Everything is being put in place for another, and I think even more frightening war than World War I and World War II. And, of course, the architect of this is the ruler of this world. But, of course, God will not be mocked. And I think he's allowing all this to happen. I don't understand why. But I do know that in the final event, God does work in the affairs of men. Go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes, he certainly does. Okay, now we have the prophecy of Daniel. We have 300 prophecies in the Old Testament referring to the coming Messiah. Wonderful, wonderful prophecies. And I think my favorite one is in Daniel chapter 9, which says there were so many years from the time when Jerusalem would be rebuilt after the Babylonian exile till Messiah would come. And this was known to all the rabbis. They knew when Messiah was coming because Daniel had told them.
And it was really, it was from the time when, I think it was Cyrus would proclaim that that Jerusalem was to be rewritten until the coming of the Messiah. Wasn't that the writing of it?
Yes, that was the first decree.
Right.
And this was the beginning of the wonderful prophecy of Daniel. Now, of course, it's good, it's helpful for us to know that Daniel was in exile when he wrote this. And the Jewish nation was scattered all over the world. Many had traveled to China, others to India. And the Jewish prophet Daniel served as prime minister in both the Babylonian and the Persian empires, didn't he? Now, his prophetic visions concerning the coming Messiah attracted greater interest than any of us have ever realized. When we go into the histories of these other nations, we find that they knew about Daniel's prophecy. And at the time, that in the reign of Darius Hystaspes, king of Persia, the mystic Zoroaster served under Daniel. And he was well versed in the sacred writings of the Jews. And seeing the good, great and wise Daniel attain such a height in the empire, Zoroaster craftily set out to adopt some of the features of Daniel's religion and mixing them up with his own fire-worshipping religion. Now, it's believed that he also conferred with Jeremiah, another prophet of the Hebrew exile. And so it turns out that in the following doctrines from Daniel, these ones appear in the writings of, or the teachings of Zoroaster, that there's one supreme God, there's a coming Messiah, there are angels, and they reveal messages to man. There's going to be a resurrection of the dead and a judgment of all mankind. That may be a surprise. He knew all those things, and he incorporated them into his religion. Now, in a collection of sacred writings composed by Zoroaster, known as the Book of Abraham, we find the same observances about meats, clean and unclean, as were given to Moses 900 years earlier. We find commands about the payment of tithes, the ordaining of one high priest overall, and references even to Joseph, Moses, and Solomon. Just as they are found in the Bible, Zoroaster also hated idol worship. And so we find the truth mixed up in error, these concepts being mixed up with the sun god and fire worship. And Mithraism, as it came to be known, became the dominant cult of the Persian and passing in empires for the next 600 years.
You know, I think it's really so amazing because we all know the biblical story of the Magi coming. We think of the three wise men. We don't know it was necessarily three, but the Magi came because they knew the Messiah was to be born. How did they know? Why? Because of Daniel's writings. And they knew where he was to be born. They knew approximately the time of his birth. I mean, it was just right to the very day what Daniel had prophesied from the time the edict went out from Cyrus that the gates, that the Jerusalem was to be rebuilt, or the walls of Jerusalem were to be built, until the coming of the Messiah would be so many days, so many weeks of years. And so the Magi knew, but they were really following some Zoroaster, weren't they?
Yes, and they, there was a mixture here of truth and error, but these men actually, these wise men, however many there were, certainly I also had a knowledge of the gospel and the stars. I do believe that it was a help to them too. And they knew them, they knew the writings of Daniel, they knew the prophecy of Jacob that a star would appear, and they made their journey. Now, the Mithra religion, although anti-Christian, soon began to tell of the mediator, of his visit to earth to defend the faithful, of his ascension to heaven, of the baptism that he instituted, of his second coming, and finally the restoration of all things and the eternal reign of righteousness, just as the Bible does. They got this from the Hebrews. But it was not only in Persia that Jewish influence spread into other religions. Jews travelled, as we mentioned, in numerous caravans right through Asia. And they disseminated their books, their doctrines, and their prophecies of the coming Messiah among the inhabitants of Asia. In fact, it's not easy to find a spot where they did not settle. And when we look at Ezekiel, he gives us, in the 5th century BC, he gives us a wonderful account of the caravan traffic with Tyre in his day, which was the same traffic as that of Confucius, of Laozi, of Buddha, and Pythagoras. Now, it was worldwide travel. Astonishing and significant is the fact that within 100 years of the death of Daniel, Zoroastrianism began to flourish with a lot of Jewish things in it. Buddhism arose in India, and Confucianism arose in China. The timing is too uncanny. Now, this is the period immediately after Daniel's prophecies began sowing the world with these electrifying conceptions. And the Jews in exile were sharing their excitement about the coming Messiah. Now, it's interesting that not only had Daniel's famous visions been taken up by Zoroaster, there was evidence that also there was a close communication between Persia and India, which made Zoroastrianism available to the Hindu people. And the Buddhist reform was based on Zoroastrian doctrine. Now, until the time of Buddha, about 500 BC, India had been in the grip of Brahmanism. And Buddhism changed idolatry from the worship of millions of gods to the worship of Buddha. Now, this teaching is permeated with ceremonies and teachings which imitate and counterfeit the earlier religion that we see in the Bible. We might ask, did Buddha, 500 BC, know about Daniel's prophecy, which gave the time of Messiah's appearance? I suspect he did know, because he is quoted as saying this: 500 years after my death, a prophet will arise who will found his teaching upon the fountain of all the Buddhas. That Buddha simply means great father. When that one comes, believe in him, and you shall receive incalculable blessings. Isn't that interesting?
I never heard that before. Yes.
Yeah.
But it all ties together. This is what's so fascinating, you know, because it was 500 B.C. when Pythagoras journeyed from Greece over to into the Near East to try to tap into the mystery religions and the secrets of the mystery religions, and brought back mathematics and geometry to Greece, which became the basis of their building of their great monuments there. But it was all based upon the secret knowledge he was able to obtain there in the Near East. And he was a teacher of the mystery religions.
Yes, it is so fascinating. Now, the same wave of Jewish influence continued on into China. And Israelites were employed in important military posts, and some of them became ministers of state in China, provincial governors, professors. And it's believed that Confucius understood and profited by the Great Reformation that a lot of these Jewish people brought to the people. And Confucius actually said, a saint shall be born in the West who will restore to China the lost knowledge. Isn't that interesting?
It really is. Well, I guess because it's been Jonathan Gray. Jonathan, how can people get in touch with your ministry?
By going to the easiest way, Dr. Stan, thank you for asking, is they go to www.beforeus.com.
Beforeus.com.
They can enroll in a free newsletter too if they choose. There's a little application form on the site.
Would you like to give that address again, once again? Because
yes.
I get your about once a week we get an email from Jonathan. Fascinating information. Go ahead.
Yeah, www.beforeus. I'll spell that beforeus.com.
All right, fine. And Sydney, if you'd like to get the Jonathan's newsletter, it doesn't cost anything. But always fascinating things to keep us, of course, focused on this supernatural battle that is going on in Sydney. All sorts of historical things and archaeological things that most people will never hear of elsewhere. Go right ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting that the influence of the scattered Jews also spread from the Middle East westward. Tacitus and Suetonius, Roman historians of the first century, bear witness to a universal expectation of a coming Messiah. And, you know, the Romans believed that this Messiah would be born in Judea. The Romans believed that. And many Gentiles, inhabitants of non-Jewish nations, looked for some great Lord of the earth to spring from Judea at that very time, the first century. And, of course, around this time, we have the record of Jesus Christ appearing and the rapid spread of Christianity worldwide. So it's very interesting that the pagan Christs were imitations of something that was given that was truth. It was perverted and became a counterfeit. But even then, later, the prophecies of Daniel permeated across the nations and an overlay of truth came, which identified that the coming Messiah really was still coming, and he was coming into Palestine. That would be the place where he would be born. So there's a mixture here of truth and error. Today's paganism is based upon the Nimrod counterfeit. But there was a time after the prophecy of Daniel when, for a period, a strong influence was felt over all these religions regarding the true coming Messiah. So we have the truth, and then we have the counterfeits. A very interesting combination.
And, of course, it still exists to this very day. This is what most people don't understand. Most people don't understand the influence of the mystery religions and their multiple counterfeit organizations. Not imaginary. They exist here in America. They exist throughout the world. They exist in all cultures, and they interlock, of course, with their common worship of the prince of this world rather than the God who created the heaven and the earth. And of course his son. Well, Jonathan, thank you so very much for being with us, and I hope we can continue this at some future date, can we?
Yes, it's been a pleasure, Dr. Stan. And by the way, we had a visitor to our home from Australia.
Go right ahead.
We had a visitor to our home from Australia yesterday. He says he listens in regularly to your program.
Really? Well, we're really blessed to know that all throughout the world people are listening to this program, and many of them will hear the rebroadcast of this. But anyway, of course, it's beforeus.com. You can go to www.beforeusus.com. And if you would like to get on Jonathan's regular, what is it, a weekly email you sent out?
Weekly email, Dr. Stan.
And
yes.
It's always fascinating. It doesn't cost anything. Fascinating information. God bless. Thanks so much for being with us, and I'll give you a call. We'll line up, of course, as we continue with this amazing story, because you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand the origins of the mystery religions and their manifestations in what is taking place geopolitically today. Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that's Jonathan Gray, and hope you've enjoyed our conversations with him. He does have a book, which we do carry. The name escapes me right at the present time, but my producer can remember it. But anyway, of course, we hope to get Jonathan on to begin to bring this all together, because you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear my talks on the Forbidden Secret, on the Dark Secret, and get the syllabus as you go with that. We have an excellent book by our friend Ted Flynn called The Hope of the Wicked. The influence of these forces, spiritual forces, can be seen in every aspect of society today. Certainly we see this in music all the time. We don't recognize it. But have you ever noticed how many of the young people in music, you know, they have great fame and great wealth and great prosperity, and then so many of them die at a very young age? Lady Gaga, reading an article recently in the Wall Street Journal, where, of course, she is, said she often weeps because she fears she is possessed by the devil. She's making, I don't know, $300 or $400 million a year today. Fascinating amount of money. But, of course, what will cost her in eternity? The DVD we hope you'll want to get is called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, put out by our good friend Joe Schimmel. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version, probably one of the most important things you'll ever watch, because, of course, it gives you an inkling of how these things are not theoretical. They're very real. They're being practiced today. If you'd like to see, of course, the DVD that Alex Jones shot at the Bohemian Grove, where the leaders of our nation, with their capes and their hoods and their candles and of course, their chants as they carry out a simulated human sacrifice before the owl. We have their secret writings, and certainly they're not supposed to be seen by anybody, but we got a set of them. And, of course, on the cover page, all it says is, we revere the owl. Who is the owl? He's a symbol of Moloch, a Baal, of course, this whole thing. And, of course, we have an excellent 2-4 CD set on the Illuminati and how the Illuminati and simply one of the mystery religions or modern-day manifestations of mystery religions ties into Skull and Bones of the Bohemian Grove. We have a 4-tape set on the Bohemian Grove. We have the DVD on the Bohemian Grove. We have, of course, a 4-tape set on the Skull and Bones. We carry the book on Skull and Bones, 2 of them. One's called The Secrets of the Tomb, written by a woman who belonged to another Yale secret society. And the other one, of course, America's Secret Establishment. But the 4-tape set, I think, gives you a tremendous insight into this secret organization. And then to put it into its context, Dr. Dennis Keddie's part 1 and part 2 of the Illuminati. It's not imaginary, very real. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, the survival of Christian civilization. So please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision, and our provision, protection, and so 1-800-544-8927. Good night. May the Lord be with you.